Okay, so for tonight's Dhamma talk, I've asked a few people if they wanted to suggest some ideas about what I should talk about, but I didn't really like any of the ideas, so I'm not going to do that. Some of them were probably good, but anyway. So I thought what I might do is give a talk on a topic. I actually gave a similar talk at Bodhnyana last week, but I give a talk on... Well, they always say that when you're teaching Dhamma, you should always talk about something that you know about from your own experience and something that you find inspiring. So I'm going to give a talk about the nature of evil. Because it's something I know from my own experience. And, well, I don't know about inspiring, but anyway, interesting, isn't it? That's something I learned at school, you know, when we were at school in our literature classes. You know, we studied John Milton, you know, his poems. He wrote two great poems, Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained. Yeah, but no one ever reads Paradise Regained. It's too boring. You know, the Paradise Lost is the interesting one. Like, why is the devil such a fascinating character? And so you have to kind of admit that, you know, there is something much more... There's a kind of fascination with kind of evil and with you know, bad people and bad characters, you know, and they always make, you know, if you're making a film or a TV show or something like that, you know, you always got to make a sort of very charismatic evil person, and that's what makes the makes it so interesting. Now, within Buddhism and the story of Buddhism, we also have our our evil, our archetype of evil, if you like. Like in Christianity, they have Judas. And, of course, you have the mythological evil, like the devil. You have Mara in Buddhism, and Mara is a very interesting topic. I won't talk too much about Mara this evening, but the human example or paradigm of evil is a monk called Devadatta. And Devadatta is very, very widely known in Buddhist community, in traditional Buddhist community, as a symbol for the baddest possible monk you could possibly have, okay? Now, in the Buddha's day, if you look at the stories and so on which are found in the Buddhist scriptures, you realize that not everybody who lived in the time of the Buddha was perfect and pure and holy and so on. Of course, there was a lot of very wonderful and inspiring monks and nuns, but also some fairly badly behaved ones. And, you know, they often, of course, as usual, or there's usually the badly behaved ones who have the most fun stories, right? But Devadatta, of all of them, is always regarded as being the most evil. He's like the worst possible evil that you could have in Buddhism. And I think I find this very kind of interesting because, you know, from one level, he actually wasn't that evil, right? I'll tell a bit about the story of him, but, you know, I can think of a lot more people who've done a lot worse things than Devadatta's done. So it's interesting to think of why, from a Buddhist tradition, he's regarded as someone who's particularly pernicious. And it's also interesting because in modern times, just like, you know, in modern times we have a very critical and revisionist look at religion, and people try to reinvent things. And so there's been quite a popular theory among Western scholars that Devadatta was actually not really a bad guy after all, that he was really an enlightened forest saint, forest monk, who was unfairly maligned by the later traditions, who were jealous of his ascetic prowess and meditative skills, and so they besmirched his name. And there's been various attempts by modern scholars to find textual support for this. This is one of the reasons I became interested in it some time ago. I was never persuaded by these ideas, but I'd never actually gone back and looked at the sources, and I went and followed and did that. And, you know, I found that there really wasn't anything to those claims. But what was interesting to me about that was to try to see and understand a little bit more about who Devadatta was and to consider what that actually means for the Buddhist tradition. Now, let me give the basics of Devadatta's story. Devadatta was a Sakyan, a relative of the Buddha. They usually say a cousin of the Buddha, although... it's not that easy really to trace in detail the Buddha's family connections. So certainly anyway, from the same clan as the Buddha. And of course, the traditional accounts will tell of all kinds of terrible things he did even as a child. He was kind of cruel and jealous and so on. But when we look at the early sources, the first thing that we learn about him was that he became a monk, probably sometime around halfway through the Buddha's career. So the Buddha had already been a monk for like enlightened for 20 years, Devadatta ordained. And he gained what the texts call the unenlightened person's psychic powers. So he's not enlightened, we're clear about that, and he's got some psychic powers. So he's got the kind of the woo-woo factor. Ooh, right? And, of course, this is one of the teachings about this whole kind of story is and it's a very important part, of, I guess, of the Reformation which the Buddha introduced, was this idea that psychic powers are actually not such a big deal. Right now, Buddhism has always accepted that there can be a genuine kinds of psychic abilities which are beyond what the mind is normally capable of, and that according to Buddhism these are typically produced by a profound development of meditation, although it seems that maybe they can sometimes come from other sources as well. Of course, in modern times, most of these psychic powers are rejected, at least by mainstream science, but there is actually a lot of very interesting studies and so on done on various kinds of psychic powers. I won't sort of go over a lot of the studies for you this evening, but if you're interested to look at it from a scientific point of view, there's a book was published a couple of years ago called Irreducible Mind, which I'm not sure if you've seen or heard of, but is an absolutely fantastic book. It's like really thick with really small type, and it's got hundreds and hundreds, like a survey of hundreds and hundreds of studies of everything interesting and fascinating that's happened in kind of psychic powers and meditative abilities and all of these kinds of things. Irreducible Mind, if you can get a hold of it, you should do so. Anyway, so Devadatta had some kinds of psychic powers. We don't know exactly what kinds of abilities that he had, except for one example, which I'll come to in a moment. So one of the points about the Buddha's teachings on meditation was that we don't meditate in order to do these things. That's a good thing to bear in mind. If you're ever looking around, so, you know, these days there's so many different meditation teachers, so many different approaches to meditation. And that's one of the things to remember. If someone's teaching meditation and saying, you know, you can meditate and get some psychic abilities or these kinds of things, that's not really what the Buddha's taught. Yeah. From the Buddha's point of view, these are things that sometimes can happen more or less as a side product of meditation, just because your mind becomes so much more sensitive and powerful. But that's not really what the point of the practice is. Of course, one of the classic stories about that was when the Buddha came to a river, and beside the river was an ascetic. And they said he had been doing these practices, and the Buddha for 20 years. And the Buddha said, "You know, why have you been doing this?" And he said, "So I can walk on water." And the Buddha said, "But there's a ferry here. You could just get the ferry and save all that time." So of course, from a Buddha's point of view, psychic powers is not the end. Can be fun, but also can be a bit seductive. So this is, I think, one of the first lessons about the nature of Devadatta and the nature of evil in Devadatta's story. This is what I'm interested to look at, because actually psychic powers aren't evil, right? I mean, if you could read someone's mind, well, good on you, terrific, you know? Might be a bit annoying sometimes, right? But it's hardly evil. Could be used for evil purposes, perhaps. But, you know, you're sitting there in line at the bank teller and you know the guy's PIN number in front of you or something like that. Yeah, you can think of all kinds of bad uses for it, but the power itself is not, it's just kind of neutral, really. So he got these psychic powers. He became a monk with a group of relatives from the Sakyan clan, Venerable Ananda, Venerable Anuruddha, and a few others, and they all became enlightened, but Devadatta didn't. But nevertheless, he was regarded as a very powerful monk. And clearly, one of the interesting things about the story, clearly Devadatta was very charismatic and in some ways there was something to him, right? He wasn't just a nobody. And if you look in the Jataka stories, the stories of the Buddha's past lives, you see in every past life the bad guy is always Devadatta, right? So life after life after life, he was the Buddha's enemy. And so it raises the question, well, how come he had the good karma to be born in the time of the Buddha and become a monk and develop these psychic powers if all he'd done for countless past lives was be a complete and utter bastard? Right? Gives you hope, doesn't it? Yeah, he could do all those things and still get so far. That makes me feel. See, this, I told you this would be an uplifting, inspiring story. So, why is that? Yeah. So, of course, we don't really know. You know, how many of these past life stories are really true. But actually, one thing that question was actually brought up in a later book in the Pali, the Melinda Panha, and the question was asked, and the answer was given by the monk then, Venerable Nagasena, and he said that, well, yes, he did lots of these bad things in past lives, but he also did good things as well, and you know, he was born in positions where he had wealth, and he gave wealth to poor people, and he was born in positions of power, and in those positions, sometimes he treated people well. And so on. So he actually did make good karma. And this, I think, is lesson the second from the Devadatta story, right? There's no such thing as absolute evil. Yeah, and people are a mixture of good and bad. And even when we come to try to look at the motivations and the nature and the character of people who are sometimes, you know, seem to be so irredeemable, but there's always a mixture. And if we're willing to accept the idea of future lives and past lives, then how much more so is that? I mean, even in one lifetime, there's nobody who's only ever bad in one lifetime, but over many lifetimes, we've all done so many good things and so many bad things. And someone like Devadatta, so you can look at it on the good side, you can say, well, he did all those bad deeds and could get born in a reasonably good life. So that in a way, that part of that's quite hopeful. But then you might think about that yourself. Then you could think, well, here I am born in a reasonably good life. You know, I'm born in a prosperous country and have the chance to come to the Buddhist society and listen to the Dhamma, and I can practice and have many blessings in my life, and you have the family and all of these things. So you must have some good karma, right, to be able to have all of these blessings. But doesn't mean you don't have the bad karma there as well, right? Like Devadatta. Yeah, how do you know? Maybe what you're enjoying in this life is just the last little bit of good karma in your bank account, and there's a huge tsunami of bad karma waiting to overwhelm you when you die, right? So you better hurry up and make as much good karma while you've got the chance now, because you never know, right? Okay, so now, the story of Devadatta goes on and becomes quite complicated. And I won't bore you with all the kind of the messy details, but the essence of the essential thing which Devadatta is accused of doing is of trying to split the Sangha. It's called Sangha Bheda, it's to cause a schism in the Sangha. Now, he's accused of many other kinds of crimes, the most notable of which is he tried to murder the Buddha. And it's not entirely clear to me whether those crimes are actually historical or whether that was part of a later development. But certainly the core of why he's considered to be so evil is that he tried to split the Sangha. Also, the sequence of events is a bit difficult to pin down. But anyway, at one point, he decided that he wanted to take over from the Buddha. He decided that the Buddha had been doing this for long enough. He was getting old. It was time for him to retire. So he, Devadatta, should become the next Buddha. Can you imagine it? What kind of conceit it takes to think something like that? And what kind of astonishing degree of shallowness in your understanding of what being a spiritual leader or whatever is, yeah? I mean, the Buddha is if you can just sort of take on the job of the Buddha and then I'll be the Buddha, you know. So anyway, he goes to the Buddha and proposes this. Right? Goes and sees him. Lord, it's time for you to retire. You're getting old. you're getting fat. You know, he didn't say that. You should live and have a peaceful abiding and I'll run the Sangha instead. To which the Buddha replied, Devadatta, I wouldn't even hand the Sangha over to Sariputta and Moggallana, my chief disciples, much less to a glob of spit like you. Right? Now that, I'm not making that bit up, okay? That's actually a literal quote from the Pali Canon, all right? And that's our earliest, most reliable source of this story, and the Buddha said that he was a lump of spit. It's a bit harsh, isn't it? Devadatta was very upset by this, as you can imagine. Must have been a little bit humiliating for the poor fellow. What's going on? Some people say, well, that shows the Buddha had anger and resentment. I mean, how could you say such a terrible thing without feeling anger inside? And how skillful is that as skillful speech? I mean, if he'd been more conciliatory, maybe he could have stopped Devadatta from doing all the bad things he did later. I don't know what the answer to that one is. It all seems a bit strange to me. I mean, one thing to understand is, of course, that the text as we have was, you know, passed down through many hands, and we don't know exactly what it was that the Buddha said to Devadatta. But certainly Devadatta wasn't pleased. Now, either before that or after that, Devadatta tried to murder the Buddha. And he did that by using his psychic powers, and he appeared before King Ajatasattu, the then Prince Ajatasattu, who was the crown prince of the most powerful kingdom at the time, which is Rajagaha. So he appears before him, and it's my favourite part of the story, he appears before him in the form of a boy with a girdle of snakes. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? Yeah, so here's old Ajatasattu sitting in his quarters, you know, enjoying himself as a prince, and then suddenly, poof, in front of him, this boy with a girdle of snakes appears. Yeah? Be quite startling, wouldn't it? Yeah? Actually, it's a very archetypal image you find in Indian iconography, this idea of like a girdle of snakes. You find a lot of the goddesses, especially the dark goddesses and gods, Shiva, Kali, are often depicted with this girdle of snakes. So Jatasattu is very startled and says, who is this? And it turns out to be Devadatta. And I find this very kind of interesting, this the symbolism of this. And I was kind of wondering what it means. And I think it can be interpreted in many ways, but there's one sutta where the Buddha talks about four things that should not be despised just because they're young. Okay? So the Buddha says four things that shouldn't be despised just because they're young. First one is a snake, right? Because a snake might be young but still be very poisonous and it can bite you, so you've got to be careful of it. Number two is a prince. Yeah? Because if you insult a prince, well, soon enough he'll be the king, and so you've got to be very careful what you say. Number three is a fire. Because even a little forest fire can grow up to become very dangerous and powerful. And the number four is a bhikkhu, yeah, a monk or a nun. Yeah, because you might insult them, but they might be enlightened. Or they might have some great psychic powers or something. So you've got to be very careful what you say. Even though somebody might be newly ordained, but they might be very mighty and powerful spiritually. So four things. So it's interesting that of those four things, three of them are there in that room, aren't they? Yeah, the snake's there, the young prince is there, and the monk is there. And so I think this is what kind of suggesting the theme of this is this idea of the generations, the overturn of the past generation. Devadatta was the new generation who's coming up. Ajatasattu is the new generation who was going to overthrow his father, the king. And Devadatta is going to overthrow the Buddha and become the new Buddha. Right? So this is what Devadatta proposes. He says to Ajatasattu, if you kill your father, King Bimbisara, who is a righteous and just king, if you kill him, you'll become the king, and I'll kill the Buddha, and I'll become the Buddha. Makes sense? Right? So you can see Devadatta's logic, right? He's using this kind of worldly logic and applying it in a spiritual sphere. So he hasn't got any kind of sense of this distinction between the two. So anyway, they go on. Ajatasattu succeeded in killing his king. And that story is one of the most beautiful and most moving stories in the whole of the Buddhist corpus of stories, how Ajatasattu killed his king Bimbisara, his father King Bimbisara, and became the king in his stead. But I won't have time to go into that this evening. Ajatasattu tried to kill the Buddha on numerous occasions. So Devadatta tried to kill him. First thing he did was he got King Ajatasattu to get the biggest war elephant and get him drunk and release him on the streets when the Buddha was going for alms round. Okay, seems like a bit of a random way to kill somebody, right? You've got this drunk, mad, rampaging elephant and you hope it's going to get the Buddha. But anyway, that's what he did. And everybody found out about it, so everybody was off the streets and everyone was saying to the Buddha, you know, don't go, this elephant's going to be there. The Buddha's saying, just chill out. And no, he says, chill out. The word in Pali is siti bhutang. It means become cool. He said, become cool. So he's going, and of course the elephant's rampaging, all the monks are scattering. Ananda was the only monk who stayed by his side saying, Lord, please don't go, the elephant's going to kill you. He says, be calm. So he walks there. And of course the rampaging wild elephant stampedes up to the Buddha trumpeting and then bows down, overcome with the Buddha's power of metta. Bows down at the Buddha's feet, becomes calm and still. So that was the first of Devadatta's plans that failed. Right? He didn't, but give him his due, right? And now Devadatta's good qualities, right? First of all, he had ambition, right? You've got to give him that, yeah? He wasn't, you know, that's why I think that's good. Secondly, he had an initiative, right? And he had perseverance. He didn't just give up after one or two attempts, no. He kept on hiring all these assassins to go and kill the Buddha, but they'd come and kill the Buddha and the Buddha would speak to them and convert them and they'd become disciples. So what are you supposed to do? So then the last time he tried rolling a rock down the hillside, and if you go to Rajagrihara and you climb up the hill to the Vulture's Peak, they'll still point to the place on the path where Ajatasattu was said to have rolled the rock down. And even though that didn't kill him, but it injured the Buddha's foot. And he then went and stayed recuperating for a while in the Jivaka Ambavana, the monastery, the mango grove of the doctor Jivaka, which again you can still see in the ruins of in Rajagrihara if you go and visit. So all of these attempts kind of failed. So then Devadatta is thinking, well, what else can I do to try to become the new Buddha? He said, well, if I can't take over and get this existing, he's stubborn old git, I can't get him to retire. So what else can I do? So he says, well, I'll split the Sangha. So here's another kind of lesson in this kind of thing of this idea of the changing over of the generations. And I think this is something quite subtle and quite profound in that in the worldly way of doing things, you know, you kill the king and become the king in the stead, well, that kind of works and it's actually quite common, right? I mean, you know, it's not so different to what happens in the Australian Parliament. Right? Just ask Kevin. And, that's how things work. That's the worldly way of things, isn't it? Yeah? And so I think the fact that didn't apply in the case of Devadatta is like the sign that the Buddha is not something like that. He doesn't get old and feeble. He's not part of that cycle of birth and aging and death. If, of course, physically he is. Yeah, physically his body gets old, but spiritually he's removed from that. And it's not a matter of somebody, you know, becoming a Buddha and getting into that post, but it's a matter of letting go, a matter of freedom, a matter of finding that same awakening and that same wisdom within one's own heart that the Buddha had. It doesn't make you take his place. So this is also, I think, one of the aspects of the evil of Devadatta, was that he, it's not just that he tried to kill the Buddha, but he sort of perverted and completely misconstrued what the nature of the spiritual path was. So then he decides he's going to split the Sangha and says, how am I going to do this? And he conceived quite a clever plan. And again, you've got to give him kudos for his persistence and his innovation. He says, well, if I'll develop a set of very ascetic rules, and I know that the Buddha won't accept these, and I'll propose them to the Buddha, and when he rejects them, I can criticize the Buddha for being too sloppy, being too lax, and we can go and start the real thing. And the ascetic rules that he proposed was a set of 5 points. I can't know if I can remember all five, but one of them was being vegetarian. One of them was sleeping only at the root of a tree. One of them was only accepting the alms that you get from the village. And another one, I think, was having only 3 robes. And I can't quite remember what the number 5 was. Anyway. So these are all practices which are regarded as permissible within Buddhism and even praiseworthy, right? All of these are practices which in themselves are quite good, but the problem was that he was trying to force them on everybody. Now, like the thing with the psychic powers, it wasn't that the psychic powers themselves were bad, but that they could be used in a bad way. And it's the same way with these practices, that it wasn't that they themselves were problematic, but that the way he used them was problematic. And this, I think, is very important. And, of course, the most significant of these 5 practices is the practice of vegetarianism. Now, obviously, this is something which many people today, and including myself, regard as a good thing to do and would want to encourage it. But, of course, there's a difference between saying it's a good thing to encourage and saying it's something that has to be enforced on everybody. Often, I believe that often this kind of thing can be quite mistaken and can be misused in Buddhism. And it can be the case in Thailand in the last few decades. There are a few kind of reform movements which started. The most well-known one today is called Santi Asok, who was like a vegetarian reform movement. And, of course, when anything like that happens, so the other monks will say, oh, yeah, they're disciples of Devadatta. So it's as if there's something wrong with being vegetarian because Devadatta did it, yeah? And that's not the point of the story at all. Yeah, actually, being vegetarian is good. But Devadatta was using something good to try to create something bad. And I think that also is part of the essence of why Devadatta was regarded as being so evil. He was taking those genuine spiritual things and twisting them out of shape, yeah, turning something which itself should be something good and actually making something dark out of it. Yeah. So he knew that the Buddha wouldn't want to impose all of these on the Sangha. So he went to him and proposed them. We should accept these 5 points. And the Buddha rejected it. And so he went off and he took with him 500 monks. Okay. Now, in the stories about Devadatta, there certainly were a few monks who were, it seems, friends of his or followers of his that he took off with him. The number 500 is a conventional term. So it probably means just a group of monks. How many he went with is not sure, but at least there were some. And that itself comes back to this idea that Devadatta was charismatic. Yeah, there was something to him. Yeah, and all of these events. I mean, even though I'm kind of joking about it, saying he has initiative and stuff, but well, he does. You know, and these are actually strong. He actually has leadership qualities, but again, they're being twisted. So he takes off 500 monks. And in doing so, he split the Sangha. And this was regarded as being, this is like the core crime that Devadatta did. And again, this crime of splitting the Sangha is often misunderstood and misconstrued. You have to understand that what Devadatta did was that he deliberately and maliciously twisted the Dhamma, twisted what the Buddha's teachings was in order to deliberately split the Sangha and to create 2 different bodies of Sangha. Yeah? That's what he did. And that's what it means when it says, often it's said in Buddhism, like there's a traditional belief in Buddhism that if you cause a schism in the Sangha that you'll go to hell, right? So that doesn't mean that if two groups of monks and nuns or whatever go off and separate, that therefore someone's caused a schism in the Sangha. You have to have the deliberate and malicious intent to distort and pervert the Dhamma by splitting up the Sangha and creating two different groups. And you have to actually achieve doing that in order to cause a schism in the Sangha in the way that Devadatta did. So again, why is this particular thing regarded as being so heinous? This is the one he's remembered for. Even he's remembered for doing this even more than he's remembered for trying to kill the Buddha. Right? It's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, you'd think killing the Buddha would be as bad as it gets. But actually, that's a bit of a non-event, really. The Buddha's like, ah, don't worry, I'm not going to die. But killing the, splitting the Sangha is very powerful. And this also, I think, is something which is worth reflecting on. Actually, you know, we live, I've studied, this is something I've studied in Buddhist history. And I don't think that there's ever been a schism in the Sangha in the sense that it's talked about through in David with Devadatta. I think that all the later generations of Buddhists were so scared of going to hell that they would not never do such a thing. Yeah? So what tended to happen is that the different groups of Sangha sort of spread out and split up and went in their own direction in lots of different kinds of ways, but without this kind of formal and deliberate schism in that sense of Devadatta. It's more like a natural evolutionary process. And sometimes, of course, there's some ill will involved, and misunderstandings and so on. Other times it's just a natural development. We live right now, right today, in a world where there are just so many different forms of Buddhism. Each Buddhist country is split into different nikayas and different sects and different practices and so on. And those groups, even those groups have subgroups and sub-subgroups and so on. So the Buddhist community is extremely diverse. And I don't think that we should see that diversity as being something which in itself is problematic. Actually, I think it's good. You know, people are diverse, they have different needs and so on, so have different ways of practicing Buddhism to respond to that, I think is good. But we should avoid, what I think is bad, is the idea of sectarianism, is the idea of saying, well, my group is the right group and everybody else is wrong. Yeah, and we've got the right way and everybody else has the wrong way. Right and wrong isn't bound up with groups in that kind of way. There's no one temple which is doing all the right things and all the others are not. There's not one Buddhist society which is doing the right things and the others are not. Actually, if you travel around the world, you see that everywhere you go, you know, I've been to many different countries and seen people practicing Buddhism and practicing Dhamma in many ways. And everywhere I go, I see people who are pretty much the same, actually. They're kind of sincere and they want to try and they struggle and they try to meditate and they think a lot instead and so on and so forth. And these, wherever you go, yeah, I think most people are pretty decent and they're trying to do the right thing. So thinking in this kind of term that, you know, we have the best form or the most pure form of Buddhism or something like that, our teacher is more enlightened than your teacher, so na-na-na-na-na. This is something we have to be very, very careful of. Yeah? You find a lot of that in Buddhism and it's really unwholesome and very, very damaging. So it's good to have the different groups and to celebrate and to support people practicing Dhamma in different ways. So anyway, Devadatta goes off, brings the 500 monks with him. He teaches them Dhamma for a while. I'm not sure what Dhamma he was teaching them, about how to be vegetarian and sleep outdoors and only have three robes and stuff. I don't know whether he actually did these things himself or whether he just told other people to do it. But anyway, and then Sariputta and Moggallana, the Buddha's chief disciples, went out to see them to bring back the 500 monks. They wanted to heal the rift in the Sangha because they knew that most of these monks who had gone with him were, you know, they weren't bad guys, they just made a mistake. So they went to see him, and Devadatta, when he saw Sariputta and Moggallana coming, said, ah, everybody, see, yeah, even the Buddha's chief disciples have come to be my students now. So they come along Devadatta says to Sariputta, why don't you teach the Dhamma? He says, I'm tired. I've got a bad back. I'm going to lie down. And it's also a very interesting little detail, because if you read a lot of the suttas, one of the things that you know is that the Buddha had a bad back. Did you know that? Yeah, the Buddha had a bad back. That's one of my favorite things about the Buddha, apart from being enlightened and stuff. So, yeah, a bit bad back, he says. And so sometimes when he's giving a Dhamma talk, he'd be like, oh, excuse me, my back's playing up, I'm going to go and have a bit of a lie down. So he'd just go and have a bit of a lie down at the side of the Dhamma hall, and one of the other monks would give the Dhamma talk. So it's pretty relaxed, isn't it? Yeah? I can't imagine doing that, really. You know, I imagine if I was talking now and then I just say, oh, look, my back's a bit sore. I'll just give the Venerable Nito finish the talk and I'll just go and have a lie down in the corner. But that's what he did. So I think that's very kind of relaxed of him. So I kind of like that. And so Devadatta, sort of the Buddha said, in there, so he says like a jackal trying to imitate a lion. He sort of did the same thing. And it was a very, very realistic detail. There's so many things in this Devadatta story which I find to be very realistic. This thing of him using the ascetic practices to sort of appear, you know, more tough and more spiritual and so on, is, you know, so characteristic in monastic communities. You know, you see this kind of thing all the time, you know, people trying to sort of competition and people trying to be more ascetic than the other, and, oh, wow, that monk's so good, he only, you know, he's only eaten once in the last 40 years once in the last 40 years, that's nothing. And and then you find out he just survives on Ovaltine and cheese or something like that. And it seems to miss the point, but it's this kind of externalizing of all spiritual things. You know, it's just you judge on externals. Whoever looks like they're the best monk or looks like they're the best nun or looks like they're the most strict or something must be the most enlightened. And so often you see, when you get to know people a bit better, you see that a lot of these things really are just show, like Devadatta did. And it's something we should really be careful of and be circumspect about, because it's very easy to be impressed by these external shows of asceticism, but they really don't tell you anything about what's going on inside. Actually, what the Buddha said and how the Buddha taught these things is that, you know, you should do these things if you need to. And one time when I was travelling around Thailand and we visited Ajahn Mahabua, the great forest master, and Ajahn Mahabua has this reputation as being like a very fierce and very ascetic monk. Now, we didn't really talk with Ajahn Mahabua himself. We talked to him briefly, but he basically just kind of laughed at us and scoffed at us and told us to get lost. So that was our experience with the great forest master. Well, there was like 500 people there laughing at us, so all the Western monks, yeah. And then we went to talk to there's an English monk who was his vice abbot there, Lompo Panyavado. And when we were talking with Lompo Panyavado, because we had this kind of group of young Western monks there with us, and it's, you know, young Western monks tend to be a bit gung-ho, especially in that monastery in Thailand. They tend to be a bit kind of everyone trying to out-tough each other. And you know, he made quite a point of saying, without anyone bringing it up, he made quite a point of saying that these ascetic practices are only useful if you're using them to counteract, you know, particular tendencies or problems that you're having. And if you're struggling in one particular area, then you need to do something to overcome that. If you find, for example, that you're overeating, then you need to do some kind of practice to kind of limit that and make sure that you only eat as much as you need. If you find that, you know, when you become a monk, sometimes there's not much to do, right? So you can just sleep a lot, right? So if you find that you're just sleeping all day, well, you need to do something to overcome that. Go and stay outside for a few weeks. Yeah, you can do this ascetic practice and then, well, it's uncomfortable and you can't sleep too much. So you can overcome these tendencies towards laziness. So these ascetic practices are not something that's to put on some show to impress people, but if you have some specific problem or issue that you need to deal with, they're there to help you to overcome those things. So anyway, so he is in the talk, and so Devadatta says he's going to gives the talk over to Sariputta to continue the Dhamma talk, and he's going to lie down a little bit. But instead of, like, the Buddha goes and lies down mindfully, Devadatta went down and lay asleep and fell asleep and started snoring. Maybe that's a real reason why monks don't go and have a little lie down while the Dhamma talk's going on. Because anyway, so Sariputta, of course, persuaded all the monks that they'd made a mistake and took them all back to the Buddha. And by the time Devadatta woke up, then they'd all gone. So, yeah, he was a bit annoyed by that. It was said that he vomited hot blood out of his mouth. He was a bit upset, I believe. So the ending of Devadatta's life, it seems that, again, I'm not quite sure of how historic the last part of his life is, but it's said that he eventually felt remorse and travelled back to where the Buddha was, intending to ask for forgiveness and to reconcile with the Buddha. But he didn't make it. While he was on the journey, the earth opened up and swallowed him down. And took him to a hot and unpleasant place underneath the earth. You know, these days we don't like to believe in literal hells of molten iron underneath the earth or anything like that. But it's very strange, isn't it, that when geologists tell us what is actually underneath the earth, well, it's hot molten iron. Anyway, so there he is for quite some time. But according to the traditions, he'll be born in the long future when his karma's exhausted. He'll be reborn and will become a Buddha in the future. And again, I think as an acknowledgement of the fact that, well, he does really have a lot of these good qualities. Some traditions say he'll be a Pacheka Buddha, like a solitary enlightened sage. Others will say that he'll be fully enlightened. So the Buddhist tradition, even though on the one hand were very critical of Devadatta and all the things he did, on the other hand, they're also accepting that he not only did good things in the past, but he will find redemption in the future. It's a somewhat curious aspect of the story that when he's, according to the traditional accounts, when he's on his way back to the Buddha to finally seek forgiveness, but he doesn't get the chance to do that. His karma is so obstructive. Yeah, it always seems a bit unfair, doesn't it? Yeah, if he'd only just gone a little further, if you visit Saravasti in India, where the great monastery is that the Buddha was staying at the time, they'll actually point to like a depression in the ground near the monastery and say that's where the ground sucked Devadatta up. So you can believe that if you like. So you know, of all the things that Devadatta did, you know, he was violent, he divided the Sangha, he lied and manipulated people and all of these kinds of things. But of all the things that he did, the thing which is kind of most remembered and most characteristic of why Devadatta was so evil was very simple. He stopped halfway. He had everything that he could have wanted, yeah, to develop and to practice. He had the opportunity to ordain. He had the great teacher of the Buddha. He had the support and the requisites to meditate. He had everything, and he had initial success in his practice, right? You know, this psychic powers thing that he got was said to that he had that after his first rains retreat, ordained, right? I mean, lots of us have been meditating for years and we haven't got anything, right? He had the psychic powers after his first retreat. That's pretty good. So he had all of these kind of promising signs, and yet he stopped halfway. For whatever reason, obviously he was conceit and there was jealousy and there was ambition and all of these things. But what are the reasons are is actually not so important, because all of us have those things, right? We've all got jealousy and we've got, you know, ambition and conceit and those kinds of things. But they don't cause us to stop practicing. Yeah? It's not the presence of those qualities which is the issue. That doesn't matter. You just keep practicing anyway. And that is what Devadatta didn't do. And that, I think, at the heart is why Devadatta is this kind of paradigm of evil, because he stopped halfway. And this was one of the messages that the Buddha said. He said, I do not ask you to do anything that's impossible. Ever think about that? That's really important. Because often when we look at the Buddha's teachings, you know, there seem to be so many things that are so difficult. You know, meditation is so difficult and enlightenment, what's that? And it seems like there's so many things that are so far away. But the Buddha said, I do not ask you, if it was impossible, I would not ask you to do it. And the essence of the Buddha's teachings is simply to recognize what is wholesome, what's unwholesome, what leads to suffering, what leads to happiness. Abandon those things that lead to suffering, develop those things that lead to happiness. That's it. It's very simple. And you have all done that. Every single person in this room has done that many, many, many times. You've all recognized unwholesome tendencies in your own mind and been able to let go of them. You've all recognized good qualities in your mind and been able to follow and develop those. Those things have already happened. You've done them. You can do them. And the only thing we need to avoid is the crime of Devadatta, is to stop halfway, is to just give up. Yeah. Okay, so that's my talk for this evening on Devadatta and the nature of evil. And that's only half the talk, but I thought I'd just stop halfway. But there. And anyway, so I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions. I don't know. Do we have a questions basket or something? I don't know. Anyway, any comments, questions? Yep. Yeah, of course.
What you commented just now, no?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Ajahn Jato. Yeah. Yep. What I was going to say is nothing on Devadatta, but on your comment, you know, you said that the Buddha had felt pain.
The bare back.
No, I remember reading this article, you know, it said that the Buddha, you know, he told his disciples that he had this, when he said he's got some physical pain, okay, when his mind is set in samsara, you know, when his mind is set in the world, you know, okay, he felt this pain. But when he set his mind out of samsara, out of this world, you know, then he overcome the pain. Did you read that?
That's right, yeah. You're sitting in deep meditation, then, of course, you can let go of it, yeah. But, when he was out of the meditation and so on, then, yeah, his body would be anyone else. Yep, go on.
The other thing is, I read, it says that the Buddha, a lot of times he felt blissful, you know, blissful. Yeah. And then the article was saying, oh, like human beings, our bliss is from orgasm, just a short while. You know, the Buddha's one is a long time, you know.
Yeah.
You know, not.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just saying, you know.
Okay. Okay, excellent. Well, that's it. The bliss of the world is only lasts for a short time, like ice cream sundaes. That's it. I remember when I was a young monk, I travelled around Thailand a little bit with my friend Ajahn Chandiko and his mum, and his mum bought us an ice cream sundae one time when we ate them, and he just looked at me and he said, I know these things are impermanent, but do they have to be that impermanent? Okay. Another question.
Yeah. Sort of fully gave up, they might go from being a sort of, you know, practicing something to a practicing nothing as a total giving up. So giving up's a bit complex. That's like another whole talk.
Could be a couple
of tips maybe on. What it means.
You do have to, because there's so many things that you can do and which can be part of what your spiritual practice is. And I do think that it's important that your spiritual practice be holistic. That means that it should affect every part of your life, right? It's not just something you do when you come to the Buddhist society. It's something that affects everything that you do. And you can find Dhamma in everything, right? You can find Dhamma in your family and in your work and all of these kinds of things. So on the one hand, you can say, well, I should find the Dhamma in that situation and I shouldn't sort of just not do it just because maybe it's difficult or something, yeah? But on the other hand, you know, it's also true that there are some situations that are just not very useful or very profitable. So you just have to learn to use your wisdom. And one of the things that for me is the most most valuable and the best way of finding those things out is you have to just leave everything aside and just take some time away from everything and don't think about it. Yeah, that's why I'm here in Bodhnyana. That's what I did. I left my I was abbot of a monastery, Santi Monastery near Sydney. Left it. I spent reigns with my father, and then afterwards, I had no idea what I wanted to do. Quite deliberately, I hadn't thought about it at all. All right, 10 years abbot of a monastery. Now I'm not. What do I do with my life? I don't know. What do ex abbots do? I don't know. There's no kind of go onto Facebook and find the ex abbots group. What do? Hang out. Hang out and talk about how the young monks today are no good or something. And so I just went back to Sydney and I literally just walked down the street. I had no idea what I was doing. And then just one night I was just sitting in the park in the grass at Sydney Observatory. It was the evening time. I'd just gone there to meditate. So just sitting there, it's quiet and peaceful. And then all of a sudden, just came to, I should go to Bodhnyana. I said, okay, that's good. So that's what I did. Yeah. And because, you know, I just wiped everything clean. I had no plan at all, no intention, no safety net, no. You know, no backup plans, nothing, just that. And so something comes up and then you can see it in a way that's really pure. You know, you don't have those kind of conflicting thoughts. And then the wisdom says, okay, that's the right thing to do. And there's like a sense of knowing. And so you have to learn to trust that sense of knowing and not listen to the fear or the uncertainty that stops you from doing what's really right. Yeah. I don't know if Devadatta had the same sense of certainty in what he was doing. Well, that's another good question, yeah. Why didn't he just get rid of him? Especially after well, this is one of the reasons why, like, modern scholarship has questioned whether some aspects are historical. I mean, it has all these things of him trying to murder the Buddha. And then after he's tried to murder the Buddha, he then comes to him and says, oh, by the way, you know, can we introduce these reforms to make the monks practice better? Yeah. So there's some of the aspects of the story that are a little bit less plausible. So, I mean, I wouldn't be so bold as to say, you know, we can recover exactly what the story was. But I think the core of it is certainly that idea that he tried to cause a schism and that... you know, up until that time, maybe he'd been quite a good monk, you know. And I think also that the Buddha would always give people the benefit of the doubt, you know. So he'd always give them people can always change. Yes. Uh-huh. Oh, when I'm talking about the Buddha, I'm talking about Sakyamuni Siddhartha. Oh, where did the previous Buddhas exist? Okay, so just to give a bit of background onto that question, according to the Buddhist tradition, the Buddha is not like a solitary phenomenon, okay? So there's the Buddha Siddhartha Gautama, who was, we know... you know, lived in a certain place and a certain time. We can go to the place he was born. We can go to the place in Kapilavastu where he grew up. We can go to the hills of Rajagaha where he practiced. We can go to Benares when he gave the first sermon, Bodh Gaya where he became enlightened, Kusinara where he passed away. And so we can say that these events happened in this place at this time. in addition to that, the Buddhist tradition has always said, and this comes back to the time of the Buddha himself, that the Buddhas appear from time to time, that the Buddha was not the only one. And the point about this is to say that the Buddhahood is really a natural phenomenon. Okay, so becoming a Buddha just means to understand the Four Noble Truths, essentially. Yeah, and so somebody who realizes for themselves the Four Noble Truths becomes awakened and becomes enlightened. And the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the origin, the ending and the path. So these are something which is it's a very subtle matter. It's very hard to realize it clearly, but it does happen. So it's quite a common thing in not just Buddhism, but all of the Indian religions have similar ideas. And the Jaina religion has a similar idea, the Hindus have similar ideas, that through past ages and through indefinite times in history, that there are people who become enlightened from time to time. So in the Buddhist tradition, apart from Siddhartha, none of the other Buddhas which are acknowledged are really historical figures. So we don't have kind of dates and places for them. We don't know that they lived in such and such a place at such and such a time. So I don't think we're really meant to. I think they're basically kind of mythological figures, and it's basically this idea that this happens from time to time, but we can't really pin it down any more clearly than that. But also, you asked a question about other world systems and dimensions. This also is very, very interesting, because from a Buddhist point of view, of course, you know, this is not the only inhabited planet, right? Aliens are fine as far as Buddhists is concerned. We've been comfortable with aliens for many millennia, right? So many world systems with many suns and many people living on them all around the universe, yeah, and Buddhas getting enlightened in them. Terrific. Because wherever you go, the truth remains basically the same. I can't, you know, you can imagine any kind of alien life form, but can you imagine an alien life form that doesn't have dukkha, that doesn't have suffering? I find it difficult to imagine what that might mean, yeah? So wherever they are, people or beings, human, I don't know if they look like humans or look like something else, but they appear and they suffer. And so sometimes there's people who understand that suffering and learn how to let go of it, and that's what we mean by Buddha. So from a Buddhist point of view, it's quite plausible to think that there may be many peoples or species and so on throughout the galaxies, and possibly many Buddhas in them. So we just have to wait and see. Yeah. Yes?
I'd just like to share something I've come across with David Dacca. There are scholars that said he existed and did his things for a reason, and that is to provide people with a bad example which we could learn from. And I think that also addressed the previous question of why not just get rid of him. There are theories that he was actually a very wise person who were helping the Buddha to teach the Dharma, in that he agreed to do these bad things as bad examples so that the Buddha can show what's the correct way to do things, and to also provide a villain to an otherwise possibly dull story.
Well, I won't comment on the otherwise dullness of the story. But yeah, I mean, curiously enough, and I'm not sure if they've related at all, but basically the identical idea has been said of Judas as well. And there's actually a Gospel of Judas. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but one of these Gnostic Gospels or so on. And it's not really, you know, it's quite late, but basically a similar idea is that Judas was essential to the story, and his role was to sacrifice himself by betraying Jesus. In the case of Devadatta, I'm not particularly convinced by that theory, because it seems to me, you know, if you look at the story in a kind of fairly straight way, that there was somebody who was a member of the Buddha's clan, who ordained, who had some early potential, but was consumed by jealousy and conceit, and who, under the influence of those bad qualities, then tried to cause a schism in the Sangha split off with his own group, but that more or less failed because he didn't have the spiritual power that the Buddha had. To me, that basic story is actually perfectly realistic and perfectly reasonable, and I don't think there's any need to look for any radical reinterpretation. Actually, that kind of thing happens all the time, right? Any spiritual group you can see. I mean, I could name half a dozen temples and Buddhist groups since you know the last 10 years I've been in Sydney where similar things have happened. One group split off from another and gone there, where for good reasons or bad reasons. So these kinds of things happen all the time. So while I think it's true that the story of Devadatta has been elaborated to some degree, but there doesn't seem to me any reason why that core story shouldn't just be taken perfectly literally. Okay, there was another question somewhere.
Yes. Ajahn, please clarify further, in what way did Devadatta stop? I mean, if he did stop, then how could he feel remorse and want to come back to the Buddha for repentance? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good question, yeah. Again, of course, he didn't stop completely, but more he paused. Yeah, but basically, you know, after his first reigns and he developed meditation and so on, and then he it seems that he kind of gave up after that. But yes, you're quite right, got back on the path. And I think this is another thing, you know, no matter how far you go, how bad you get, then there's always that chance of redemption. Yeah. Yeah, the Buddha didn't want us to suffer. You know, there's something you need to think about when sometimes you make a mistake, you do something bad, you hurt somebody, you know, get angry or whatever. And then afterwards you feel really remorseful and you're like, oh, I feel so bad about that. And you just remind yourself, the Buddha didn't want me to suffer. Yeah, he wanted me to let go of this. Okay. So, any last questions? Okay, so we should probably wrap up, and I'm not sure, are there any announcements to be made before we finish? Or were the announcements done beforehand? Before was all announcements, okay. Okay, so we'll finish up, and hopefully I'll see you, I think, tomorrow afternoon for Sutta. No, not tomorrow afternoon, meditation. And Ajahn Brahmali is doing the Sutta class on Sunday. And the planting of the Bodhi tree at Dhammasara on Sunday afternoon.